All right. Now, you mentioned something there, banning private contributions.
Yes.
So you're saying that the electorate should know who makes political contributions and the quantities?
And the quantities, yes.
All right. Akash Miraj?
We do take the position as an organization, as a global organization, that all campaign contributions and indeed all contributions to political parties should be declared so the public can know who's donating the funds. We also take the position that there should be limits on the amount of money that any one person or any one company can donate to candidates to dilute the effect of individual groups basically taking ownership of politicians. We do not, as an organization, call for an outright ban on all private contributions. We do feel that there is some place to allow modest contributions, both so that individual citizens who want to make offer support to their candidates and to their parties are able to do so, but also as some a way of compelling political parties and candidates to remain responsive to their constituencies between elections. In other words, if you have to rely on a large number of small contributions between elections, you might be more alert to the need of your constituents. But we do feel that there has to be significant limits so that no one person or no one group can exercise disproportionate and undemocratic influence over elected officials.
All right. Now, Mr. Miraj, one second there. Just if you could, you know, add or just tell me as well, do you think there's anything else besides the donors and the amount that they give that should be disclosed in terms of the disclosure?
Any relationships between the candidate, the candidate's family, and the seat, and the immediate political staff of the candidate, and the donor, we feel that is necessary so that if there are other means, for example, there are many ways to pay back favors. One of them is, or to make contributions available. So, for example, a company might write a check to a candidate. If they're frustrated in that, they might hire the candidate's son or daughter or spouse to work for them on the payroll and therefore get around campaign contribution limits in that way. If there's one thing that I can say, looking at attempts around the world to regulate campaign finance reform or political finance reform, it is that economic actors have displayed an infinite level of creativity in trying to dance their way around regulations meant to restrain them.
All right, you had a comment.
Yes, I was going to say that, you see, one of the reasons why I suggested, and I'm suggesting, that all contributions be banned is because once you go down the road of allowing persons to make donations, they'll find a way around no matter what you put as the limits. Because, for instance, in the United States, you see, you form a political action committee. You form a committee and persons give money to the committee, and then the committee uses the money to influence the political outcome. So it seems to me that whatever limits you're going to put, some persons are going to become very creative in finding ways around it. And so it seems to me that while it is useful to say yes, constituents should be able to make a donation and a contribution to their candidate, well, let the individuals pay their taxes, and then their taxes are used to finance the campaign. And so indirectly, they are giving to the political parties. But then it is more accountable because it can be distributed in some sort of even fashion that we can decide who gets how much based on their performance or based on something. In other countries, it is done in some countries.
All right. Mr. Miraj, when you say capping the contributions, do you have an idea of, do you have an amount in mind?
Because we are a global organization, a global institution, we have shied away from naming specific amounts because the circumstances of different countries vary so dramatically. In a country like Antigua and Barbuda, which I believe has a total population of less than 100,000 people, the reasonable economic needs to run a campaign are very different from a country, for example, like India that has 1.3 billion people and where you might have an individual MP's constituency that has several million people in it. But we do think that the question of what is an appropriate campaign limit should be decided through a national debate, and there should be a national consensus behind it. There are some countries, like the United States, that effectively have no limits whatsoever. The United States, it's a complicated situation, but I would say that although they have some laws that say that, that cap contributions in some cases, the existence of things like super PACs or 527, so-called 527 or 501c4 organizations means that in reality there are no limits. And for super PACs, for example, our last audit shows that there are about 800 of those in the United States. They have raised about one-third of $1 billion, billion with a B dollars, for candidates. And the vast majority of all that money, the vast majority, the third of $1 billion, came from fewer than 100 people. And that suggests, you know, just vast amounts of tens of millions of dollars being put into campaigns by a handful of individuals. And no one puts tens of millions of dollars into any kind of enterprise without expecting to get tens or hundreds of millions of dollars out of that enterprise.
And nobody does anything out of the goodness of their heart anymore. Now, Juno Samuel, let me ask you this.
Oh, the heart now, is good.
The heart is good.
It's just that the money must come back.
I see. All right. Now, you two gentlemen have been speaking all afternoon about ways to circumvent regulations, including political parties understating contributions, dubious characters, mm-hmm. or even if they're not dubious, and there's a cap, making the donations individually, forming these PACs, political mm-hmm. action groups, or making donations through other individuals. So the question is, though, and I'll start with you, Juno mm-hmm. Samuel, do these regulations really make a difference?
Well, it depends on how you structure them. They could make a difference. And I go back to my original point of suggesting public financing. And they would make a difference because then if you ban all political contributions, then you're getting rid of that. Therefore, there's no contribution from anybody either. And that would mean not only in cash, but in kind. I think the gentleman mentioned that, for instance, if you, if I'm an ally of you as a political candidate, I can find ways to help you out. I might employ your wife and your son. I can do all these things for you. I can make representation for you in certain businesses and make it easy for your business to make money. I can do all these things without actually giving you dollars, so that all these would have to come under scrutiny as to what do you do for this person who has given you this money. And so let us eliminate that. And then we put teeth in the regulation to make it very difficult for you to receive any kind of assistance, either as a candidate or even after you become elected and you're in public office, you see, where gifts are given to you and nobody wants to account for it. Who gave you? You know, trips are given. that's, which seems to me to be one of the most ludicrous things I've ever heard. So that there are ways that people can try to get around these, and I'm suggesting public financing.
All right, so Mr. Marr, same question. With the inventiveness of individuals, do the regulations really make the difference or achieve what it is that you want them to achieve?
They absolutely do make a difference. Across the world, attempts to regulate campaign finances or party finances is a bit like an arms race. You always have one side bringing in regulations, another side trying to subvert those regulations, new regulations to plug the loopholes. No system is perfect, but the worst situation of all is no system. In other words, it's possible to create laws that nefarious actors will subvert, pervert, or evade. But if you have no laws at all, then you make it too easy for them. The second thing I would say is that while we are focusing, rightfully so, on the abuse of money in politics, it's important, I think, to emphasize that this isn't predicated on the assumption that all politicians or all political actors are ill-intentioned. I would say that politicians are, in any democracy, politicians reflect the societies from which they come. They are good and they are bad. The important thing is that there is an incentive structure that means that good people can succeed and that people with ill intentions are thwarted. I think there's a special challenge for a country like Antigua and Barbuda, and indeed many of the countries across the Caribbean, and that is that with relatively small populations, the ability to have truly independent institutions becomes limited. In a country that might have tens of millions of people, it's possible to create incentive. It's easier. It's not easy, but it is easier to create incentive or oversight institutions that are completely independent of the people they are overseeing. The smaller the population, the more likely it is that there are connections, familial connections, business connections, social connections between the people doing the regulating and the people who are being regulated. But that is a reason to try harder. It's not a reason to give up.
All right. Now, Mr. Miraj, let me just, since you're on that, what would, if it's a must-have, okay, what would be some of the must-haves in any legislation that deals with campaign financing?
In our experience, going across the world and looking at what has worked and what has failed, the first is strict limits, published limits on how much money can pass between any one individual or organization to the political process. The second is clear public disclosure, so that all amounts of money, no matter how large or small, are disclosed to the public so everyone knows who's donating money to whom. The third is conflict of interest registers, so that the public is able to know who has cash or non-cash influence over elected officers, so that they can judge for themselves whether their politicians are accountable to them or accountable to third parties. And I would say the final thing is a free and independent media. At the end of the day, democracy is not based on trust. It's based on skepticism and vigilance. And having a professional core of journalists and citizen organizations who make it their business to blow the whistle when they see something going wrong, there's simply no substitute for that.
Jonah Samuel, those are some of the must-haves that you think definitely should be in this type of legislation.
Well, before you begin the legislation, I think one of the first things we must have in Antigua is political education, re-education of the population to understand what is involved whenever there are no effective campaign finance regulations, and how influence can be peddled so that the public understands that simply because you may be receiving some sort of benefit from the politician, it is always the person who is giving huge sums of money who is receiving even larger benefits than you can ever dream of. And so they are the ones who really actually own the system, and you are just a pawn in the system. And so that re-education has to happen before people understand, well, look, it's important that we have campaign finance reform, and what that reform will take, what form it will take. And I'm reiterating, and I'm very I'm unmoved on the idea that it should be public financing. Antigua is a very small place, and it seems to me that no matter what limits you put or how you try to surround that and allow people to make donations, there is always going to be a significant problem. And the other thing is, I think, that once you put that in place, included must be severe penalties for breaking those rules. Severe penalties. And when I say severe penalties, not just a fine, because those same persons who are giving contributions will assist to pay that fine. Severe penalties to the point where persons can be imprisoned, so that people understand that this is a serious matter. Because I think that is important for a population to understand that if we allow ourselves to go down that road, we really don't have a democratic process.
All right, but let me get Mr. Mirage's his take on that. Should a politician be imprisoned for breaching campaign financing laws?
Absolutely. There's no question in my mind. If someone were to go down to a grocery store in St. John's and hold it up at gunpoint and steal $1,000, there's no one in the entire country who would hesitate to say that person should be facing jail time. I don't see how someone who robs the country up tens of thousands hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars should be treated any more leniently. I think that people make a mistake in democracies to believe that corruption is somehow a victimless crime. It is not. When political actors steal money, they are stealing it from you and from me. There are hospitals that are unbuilt. There's healthcare that's not provided. There are people who go uneducated because the money that should have done those things have been stolen by political actors. When a politician commits those crimes, he or she should be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard, than an ordinary citizen, because in addition to committing the crime, that person is also betraying the public trust, betraying his or her country.
Right, and in preparing for this segment, I saw a phrase that I thought was interesting, where it said that an election is too important a thing to be left up to the electorate. Now, we'll move on from that. And depending on which side of the fence you're on, that might actually make sense. If you're one of the contributors that we've been talking about.
Well, maybe they're referring to a misguided electorate, because, you see, democracy requires us to have a certain understanding of how the system works and what it means, what a democracy means,
right,
and therefore what our responsibilities are.
But if you are one of the actors that we're talking about here, mm-hmm. someone who like an influence peddler,
yes,
then you don't want to leave certain things up to the legitimate electorate. But we'll move on from that. Now, the John Ash bribery scandal here. Now, that's brought into sharp focus that political parties, like every other entity, needs money mm-hmm. to survive. Now, what's the answer, if not donations? What is the answer, Mr. Samuel?
As I indicated, you see, the politician said, well, I had to call upon persons. And politicians will tell you that. I go out and solicit campaign donations. You see, once you have that as a mindset, I'm going to solicit from someone, I don't care who it is, the point comes back over and over again. The persons who are giving you these funds are not giving out of the goodness of their heart. It doesn't work that way. They're looking for something. They want influence. They want ability to be first up on the list, to have contracts. They're looking to get inside information as to where the next road is going to be built or where the next public facility is going to be located, so they can buy that land. And then when the government wants it, then they have to negotiate and sell it back to them. They're looking at all these things. They're calculating in their mind, I give you $1 million. I have certain things in mind that I am going to put on the table, and therefore you're going to look at it favorably, and I will get $2 million back. You
all
see.
All right. So if not donations, Mr. Mirage, what's the answer? Or donations with provisos?
My own sense is that donations should be limited, but not bad. Strictly limited, because if you have people who are donating small amounts of money, they can't then embark upon that kind of calculus. You can't own a politician for a $25 donation. Or at least you can't own any politician I've ever met for a $50 donation. And there is an advantage, I think, to allowing small amounts of contributions, and that is that it does, to a certain extent, democratize party financing. There is a good deal of virtue to having publicly financed parties and publicly financed campaigns, and many countries have gone that route, particularly in Northern Europe and Scandinavia. And they, I think, have less or fewer campaign scandals than other countries. But they don't have none. And it's important, I think, for us to recognize there's no ideal or perfect situation. There's only the best approach given the specific circumstances of a specific country. One of the potential downsides of having parties that are financed entirely by the taxpayer is that ultimately it is the politicians themselves, as legislators, who decide upon the rules that determine which parties get how much money. And there have been cases where it becomes a slippery slope, where parties start to give themselves more and more money, where they become more and more disconnected from the population, where they become independent not just of people who want to exercise illicit influence, but they become independent and indifferent to the people they are supposed to be representing, because they get all the money that they need from unwilling taxpayers. I mean, that is not to say that public financing of campaigns is a bad idea. That's only to say that it's possible to take take any solution to an extreme that defeats its purposes. Ultimately, I think what the people of Antigua and Barbuda will have to do is it's an ongoing process of seeing what works and of refining it as gaps are identified. But I think the fact that there is clearly a debate in the country right now about the propriety of campaign financing, that is the beginning of the ideal solution. And it is vitally important that any solution that is agreed upon is one that is supported by the broad population and not just by a small group of legislators meeting behind closed doors.
All right, now let's talk about that, Juno Samuel, mm-hmm. a small group of legislators. Now, it's said that Caribbean MPs avoid enacting certain legislation, such as term limits for prime ministers, because they have to live with it. Now, we're talking about the same set of people enacting legislation about campaign financing. Mm-hmm. How optimistic are you, given that that is the case, that campaign finance reform will materialize?
Well, I'm not optimistic that the politicians will one day get religion and decide, well, look, okay, we're going to have campaign finance reform and have the public participate and so on and come up with some rules. But I believe that an educated population, a re-educated population, which becomes dynamic enough and interested and understand the pitfalls and the difficulties of having your politician being bought, if the population becomes interested enough that they will make it even a campaign, a platform or litmus test for electing politicians. How do you feel, Mr. Politician, about X, Y, or Z on the plate as if you become the politician? And if the politician is resistant to that or understand that you're going to have to legislate or else you're not going to win, you see, issues like that have to come to the table and not just flimsy things that people discuss in our politics. If the population understands clearly, there has to be a campaign for them to understand this, and it should be on your radio shows and your program, on and on, the dangers of having your politicians bought. Then if people become interested enough that they will demand that this happen, then I can see it happening. And I hope that the young people, in particular, that they will see that their entire future is tied up and wrapped up in this. Because, as the speaker said, when the politician goes out and gives to his friends contracts into the millions of dollars to do whatever they need to do for them to make money, it means that monies are not there to be spent on other things that are absolutely important. And you, I can say, I'm sure you are struggling with that. Teachers are not there. Books are not there. The school needs repair. Roads that are dilapidated. All these things may well be, or are tangential to, the idea that somebody is getting very wealthy by giving monies to the politician, and therefore they're in a position to influence the actions of politicians. And if people understand that, then they will demand that there should be campaign finance reform. Whatever it takes, whatever the format is, we don't know, but have a solid discussion about it and put some things on the table as to how we're going to go about avoiding as much as we can the influence of big money in politics.
All right, Akash Miraj, is that the weakness in the system, that it is in fact these politicians that has to legislate against themselves getting unregulated money?
I would say that is both the tragedy and the triumph of democracy. The democratic process does not rely upon us being governed by angels. It relies upon us being governed by human beings who are alert to their own self-interest. And the idea being that a politician will do the right thing, not because it's the right thing, but because there are votes in it. As a result, it is incumbent upon the population to say, we will vote for and we will support those politicians. We will reward those politicians who will enact the laws that are in our best interest. And also, I mean, I do emphasize, there are lots of people who are standing ready to serve and want to do the right thing. It's important that they be rewarded by the population by being elected and by being propelled to positions of power so that they can do the right thing. I feel I should mention that the Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption does have a member in Antigua and Barbuda, Eustace Lake of St. John's Royal South, I believe he's known as Tico Lake in the country.
Yes, he is.
But the basic idea, when you look at countries or situations in history where politicians have gone off and done what they believe to be right, irrespective of what the population thinks, sometimes you've ended up with a Gandhi, sometimes you've ended up with a Stalin. The idea of democracy is that the people are the best judges of what is in their own best interest, and they have an opportunity to elect those individuals who best represent what they feel is in their best interest. I think one of the great unspoken challenges of anti-corruption is that often, and this is true in countries across the world, people are more apt to vote for politicians who they think will be corrupt in their favor. In other words, instead of thinking to themselves, we want to elect a generation of politicians who are honest, they think we want to elect a group of politicians who will give us our turn at the trough. And the hardest thing in fighting corruption, be it through party financing or corruption in general in politics, is creating a national culture where people understand that it is in their best interest not to have someone who will steal and give them some, but to have people who won't steal at all.
All right. Thanks so much for your contribution. Akash Miraj, he's the CEO of Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption and for Transparency. And we had in studio with us Juno Samuel, Chairman of the Antigua-Barbuda Electoral Commission. Gentlemen, it's been an education. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.